Thank you for gathering to hear these curious tales. I have worked here in the Egyptian Hall since it first opened in 1812. My name is Alfred, and I am the custodian here. I have been a bystander to all these small happenings and unexpected events. The first of our curious tales concerns Mr. Hayden, the painter, who often showed his work here, most recently in 1846. The story is told by his wife, Mary, whom I remember well.
"25 years ago, while my first husband was dying, Benjamin Robert Hayden, artist, painter in the grand manner and champion of high art, paid a neighbour of mine 2 shillings and 6 pence to let him sit at their parlour window and watch my comings and goings. He noted in his daily journal that my face was the loveliest ever created since God made Eve. 5 years later, we were married. Unknown to him, I always secretly read his daily journals, which run to 26 volumes. But the latest pages he made available for me to read, a consequence of which was my last visit to the Egyptian Hall, the scene of both his greatest triumph and his recent downfall. I had begged him over and over again to declare himself bankrupt and avoid the King's Bench prison for all our sakes. He knew he must either do that or abandon his historical paintings and get portrait commissions to satisfy his creditors. Those were his only 2 options. On the evening of the 21st of June, 1846, he called me into the painting room where he was working on The First British Jury, and asked me to sit at the table for a moment. His journal was open at the 17th, his having received a £50 contribution from Sir Robert Peel. I could not help but read it, and I became aware of him watching me. The entry finished with, 'Mary, with a woman's passion, wishes me at once to declare myself bankrupt. I will not. I will finish my 6 planned historical paintings under the blessing of God, reduce my expenses, and hope his mercy will not desert me.' Once he knew that I had read it, he crossed to me and closed the book. He said he had reconsidered his words and matters would be resolved. To that end, he wanted me to go to Brixton the following morning and fetch David Coulton, as he needed to discuss matters with him, which raised my hopes for a bankruptcy. David had been a great friend of his for some 8 years. I agreed wholeheartedly. Ben had a sleepless night, yet he rose early and went out about 8:30. I overheard him asking Elizabeth, the housemaid, if she knew at which end of Oxford Street number 315 was, but she didn't. He came back shortly afterwards and went straight to his room. Wherever he had been, he kept it from me, which made me all the more curious. 315 Oxford Street. I left for Brixton earlier than I had intended to see what the premises were, but the heat was too much for me. London was an oven, and as I passed the Egyptian Hall, the thought of the marble coolness drew me towards it. I passed under the main portico with its giant statues of Isis and Osiris. Tom Thumb was still the attraction in the great hall, while the smaller room, where Ben's exhibition had been withdrawn, was still empty, awaiting the arrival of 9 Ojibwe Indians from Lake Huron with their war dances. Ben said, 'General Thumb is doing for high art what Samson did for the Temple of Dagon.' To his dismay, just as 21 years ago they rushed in their thousands to see his painting of Christ's entry into Jerusalem, they now rush to see Mr. Barnum's American Dwarf. The audience had begun to arrive for the first show of the day, and Alfred slipped me into the empty exhibition salon with a glass of water. I asked him if 315 Oxford Street meant anything to him. It didn't, but he would try to find out if he could. I looked up, and General Tom Thumb entered the room. He came towards me like a small wax doll. He was 24 inches high and weighed only 15 pounds. His make-up, which had been applied to make him look older, was melting in the heat.
"What are you doing in here?"
He spoke with bravura and the voice of a child. I told him I was sheltering from the heat, and he grunted. He asked if he could join me. He used to come into this room when Mr. Hayden's picture exhibition was on to escape from the crowds.
12,000 people come every week to see me," he said. "I met Queen Victoria. Her poodle attacked me, but I soon put paid to him."
He told me he liked the pictures, especially the one of Rome burning. But nobody else did. He said Mr. Hayden, his friend, had confided in him that he was going to paint the biggest picture in the world, even bigger than the one by Tin something. "Tintoretto," I said. "Tintoretto's Paradise."
"Do you know Mr. Hayden, then?"
"A little."
"Did you see his exhibition?"
I nodded.
"Have you been in to see me?"
"No," I replied. He gave a stiff little bow, astonished.
"Why not?"
I shrugged. He looked glum.
"Mr. Dickens said he could barely look at Nero and keep a straight face."
"Yes," I replied. "I have heard what Mr. Dickens said. But then I also know what masterpieces these would have been with financial patronage and 7 years to paint them. He painted both in 6 months."
"Times change," said the dwarf, "and what people want. That's why Mr. Barnum says I am blessed. I have no talent. I'm a curiosity. I'll be famous till I die. I'm not wanted for anything that I do, simply for being as I am."
He then added perkily,
"Guess which picture of Mr. Hayden's I like the best." "Go on, Mom, you have to guess. Who am I?"
With that, he did the most extraordinary thing. He leapt onto a chair and pulled himself into the pose of Napoleon musing at St. Helena, as in Ben's portrait. He beamed.
"I really like that."
Suddenly, a deep American voice called from the foyer.
"Charlie! Charlie!"
Charlie, for that was his name, said he had to go. No matter. He knew he had won me over. He did one or two dance steps, sang a few lines of Yankee Doodle Dandy, then, with a broad smile, he gave a neat, stiff bow and disappeared as fast as he had arrived. Just as I was about to leave, a shaft of sunlight lit up the end wall, and for a moment I imagined I saw the entry of Christ into Jerusalem, where it had hung all those years before. I was jolted back to the present as below me Alfred and the 9 Ojibwe Indians from Lake Huron burst into the room. He could shed no further light on 315 Oxford Street. I took a hansom cab to Brixton, where Mr. Coulton was surprised to see me, but set off with me straight away for home. I explained to him that I thought Ben was considering declaring himself bankrupt, which we had been urging him to do for some time. He was astonished. It was something Ben had always sworn against. He asked what it was that made me so certain. I gave my reasons, and explained how Ben had risen that morning before 8:30 and visited someone at 315 Oxford Street. Mr. Coulton became quiet at this. I asked him if he knew who he had been to see. He said the owner was a man called Isaac Renier. I asked what he did. He said that he ran a club. But why should Benjamin go to a club at that time of the day? He asked me if anyone was with Benjamin at home. I could tell he was clearly anxious and keeping something from me. I said no. I asked what my husband could possibly have been doing there. I tried to jest, but David remained silent. What sort of club was it? We were approaching the park, and the traffic became heavier. We could hear the sound of a military band. He said it was a sporting club at the rear of a shop just beyond Oxford Circus, towards the Tottenham Court Road. There was an indoor shooting range. The shop itself was... well, Isaac was a gunsmith. As we went through Hyde Park, you could hear the artillery exercising, the repeated boom of the cannon and the crowds cheering. I covered my ears. The only sound I heard in my head was breaking my heart.
Matters would be resolved on the morrow.
It was the sound that Benjamin thought I would want to hear. A single shot being fired from an artist's gun. Our daughter Mary reached home before I did and found her father in his painting room. Ben had shot himself in the head with the pistol purchased that morning from Isaac Renier. But it was too small a caliber to kill him, and he had ended his life with two razor slashes across his throat. His journal was open on his desk. His last entry.
God forgive me. Amen. Finis of B.R. Hayden. Stretch me no longer in this rough world. King Lear. End of 26th volume.
When I look back on that day, I try to tell myself that he had committed the deed before I left the house, when I was still just a room away, when I was anywhere but in the Egyptian hall with the American dwarf. Did I hear any sound that could have been a gunshot? Any sound of him falling? Anything? Anything? Any sign at all? But I don't think so. I'm ashamed to say that I found some comfort from words that appeared in the Times newspaper against young General Tom Thumb. The patronage which would have ransomed his pencil and restored his peace was lavished on a rival exhibition at the Egyptian Hall of the most puerile and offensive character. The display of a disgusting dwarf attracted hordes of gaping idiots who poured into the yawning pockets of a Yankee showman a stream of wealth, one tithe of which would have redeemed an honourable English artist from wretchedness and death. Ben's Noodles and Boodles of London, as he called them, paid a shilling to see General Tom Thumb, a shilling to see Christ's entry into Jerusalem. He once paid 2 shillings and 6 pence to see me leaving my house, the loveliest face created since God made Eve. Tastes change. He only portrayed me once. Everything changes. If you care to see my face, search for that of a dead woman, fallen, with a baby at her breast, to the right of the canon, in his painting, The Maid of Saragossa.